This is the Digital Savage Experience Podcast, hosted by Roman Prokopchuk, bringing you all things digital marketing, tech, business, and motivation. What's stopping you from becoming relentless in all aspects of life? Are you ready to become a digital savage? Let's get into today's episode.
Hey everyone, it's Roman Prokopchuk, and this is the Digital Savage Experience Podcast. Today I have with me Matthew Gallagher. He's a Los Angeles-based entrepreneur, which started in terms of his roots in computer engineering and digital marketing. He's the founder and CEO of WatchGang, which has achieved $300 million in sales and is the largest watch club in the world. So we're going to be talking about that, how that happened, his childhood, his upbringing, and how he became who he is today.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it. I'm excited to have a conversation.
My pleasure. So how did you get to where you're today? Kind of, you know, your upbringing, things you may have overcome. How did you end up who you are in 2023?
Well, grew up very poor. I lived in a trailer park when I was first born. There's a whole lot that goes into that, I think. And, you know, I think you can kind of find yourself going in my direction or in the direction of sort of replicating what you grew up in. And I kind of ran away from that. But I think that I had a role model to kind of aspire to become. So when I think a lot about like why everybody doesn't climb out of that situation, I think what I've experienced is that they generally didn't have anybody to kind of look up to, maybe in their immediate surroundings. You know, when you grow up in the ghetto or in like a trailer park or inner city type of thing, there aren't a lot of people that are providing a positive influence. And I had my uncle. And so my dad's brother was a big influence on me. And he gave me my first computer. I had like this old crappy IBM ThinkPad laptop that he was going to throw away. And he gave it to me when I was 12. And I was in like a Walmart and I saw a Net Zero internet CD. I don't even know if they were everywhere or just in the Midwest, but essentially you'd get free internet if you had a phone line, as long as you let ads get plastered all over your screen. And so that was my kind of first entry into the internet. And I was obsessed. I figured it out pretty quickly. My dad didn't get it. He was like, "Why aren't you outside playing baseball?" And I was like, "Hey dad, this is gonna make me rich one day." And he just kind of laughed. He's like, "Okay, buy me a boat." But I got obsessed with it really early on and just kind of learned everything through there. I mean, that's like a Cliff Notes version, I guess. And then I started this this watch company about 6.5 years ago after my dad died, and I got his watch that I had gifted him years before. And it kind of like this watch made a full circle, and it made me really interested in timepieces in general and the stories surrounding them.
That's awesome. And do you think if you didn't have that kind of positive role model, you may have stayed in that? Now, was kind of like growing up poor in that situation, was that more generational? Because a lot of stuff, my wife and I are foster parents, so we fostered 29 kids in 4 years. And a lot of the issues, you know, poverty, substance abuse, mental illness are generational. It's tough to even break that. So was that something that was more generational, or was that like, you know, that just happened?
Yeah, it was absolutely generational. I probably would have ended up as like a homeless drug addict, you know? I mean, that's unfortunately, a lot of people I grew up with have died of overdoses, and they're homeless or they live still in extreme poverty. And that's, I mean, I have to attribute it to something. I didn't like just have a special, you know, something about me. I was always interested in like entrepreneurship and stuff, but you know, I don't, you never know. Like I truly believe maybe there are things that happen around me when I was like 5 or 6, maybe I saw a certain show and it just gave me like a bug to, you know, to want more. It's hard to explain. You know, I think now with the internet though, if you have any sort of access to the internet, it's hard not to see and be influenced by people kind of grinding and making it out. So I just didn't have that when I was first growing up.
Yeah, I agree. It's also somewhat of a cheat code. So now you go on YouTube and you can kind of reverse engineer anything you want to learn, and you don't necessarily have an excuse. I mean, reoccurring themes, I often, you know, explore things like, let's say there's two siblings, one stayed in that generational kind of, you know, mindset and using it as a crutch. You know, I'm in drugs, alcoholism, I'm now in prison because of my upbringing, because of my family. And the other one used it as, you know, fire to drive you. So it's really interesting how people can make a, you know, a turn into the right direction and wrong direction, and what factors play into that as well. So how did you kind of end up in LA? Obviously, you said you were, you know, in the Midwest.
I wanted to be an actor. When I was in Ohio, and I just got the, I remember when I was a kid, I just remember loving movies and shows, and I wanted to be part of that. And as I grew up, I really kind of chased that. I had an agent in Ohio. I did like some indie films and regional commercials and stuff. And then some agent in LA offered to rep me. So I moved out here, and then I was doing all right, actually. I was in Normandy filming a movie when I got the call about my dad dying, and it kind of threw everything into perspective for me, and I just stopped caring about it. I think that I just wanted to be famous and didn't actually care much about acting. And so then I felt that was really like a vapid aspiration to have. And then I started doing the company, and I just liked that a lot more. And I stayed in LA.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, oftentimes trauma or loss causes you to reevaluate where you are in life and what you're doing and what's truly important. I mean, I haven't had a good relationship with my father. I haven't spoken to him in over a decade, but both of my grandparents passed away fairly recently. And it's one of those things, you kind of think about life, how short it is. Are you really doing what you're, you know, doing to be happy? And obviously that impacted you from the fact that, you know, he left you that watch, and you have that kind of emotional tie. So I think when you structure a company or organization or anything you do, nonprofit, around something that's meaningful, like, that drive and passion is already there as a foundation. I was actually like in the first year or two in watch gang as well. So I was on like the Fridays when you did the kind of the wheel spills and stuff like that.
So I'm super curious. Like, you said you haven't talked to your dad in how long? Like 10 years?
2008 was the last time I saw him in person.
You know how like you're a kid and then your dad is like a superhero, and then, you know, I don't know what happened with you guys, and then you have this falling out. You know, have you like humanized him yet? Like, do you know where, like, what his background was and what led him to do whatever he did that made you stop talking to him?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of domestic abuse, and I saw it, different things of that nature, infidelity in terms of the relationship with my mom. And I think when I got to a certain point, I said, I don't want to be like that, like changing that trajectory now, fostering 29 kids. That started with my wife and I experienced 6 miscarriages in 3 years, and this whole, you know, journey. So me personally, I forgave him, but it was one of those things as a reflection. It showed me who I didn't want to be. So seeing that trauma, that abuse, that domestic abuse, it showed me like, this is the experience I have. This is how it's making me feel. I don't want another child in the future. I don't want to make somebody else feel like that, or, you know, pass that on. So, but yeah, starting the business, you started the business. What made you decide to kind of start a subscription-based kind of watch club? Is that something like you thought was the best option for people to attain, like kind of like the value that you got of that watch from your dad? Or did you explore kind of different business models, or how was that kind of like decision to start?
I had started dozens of random small companies since I was a teenager. I love the subscription model in general, just because you get this kind of reliable recurring revenue from what you're building. That has actually saved my company several times throughout like COVID, the recession, iOS update that kind of crushed advertising. So it has at least kept the wheels on the thing. So that was a good move. But I started it because I like the idea of people building a collection. So they always, you know, they keep what we're sending them. And at the time, I was tapping into a market that definitely needed us. There was so much inventory that companies couldn't move. back in 2016 and 17 in the sort of fashion watch market. What would normally happen is you'd have a brand, they would sell online a bit. Back then, MVMT was like the only, and Daniel Wellington, they were like the only fashion watches that were really doing well online. Everybody else, you know, they're selling in retail, and then when stuff doesn't move, they put it on the shelf at TJ Maxx next to a bar of deodorant, and it looks terrible for their brand. And so we sort of tapped into this members only club idea that they could sell their stuff at like wholesale price and it wouldn't hurt their branding because it was done like sort of behind the scenes in this like login environment. And so, yeah, I think that I just got very lucky with that business model and it worked out very well. And then we, you know, we found at some point we're selling so many watches that brands don't have enough now for us. So then we started doing collabs with brands and they would develop pieces for us. And, you know, we have really good data on what people like based on NPS scores of watches. And so we could approach a brand like Citizen and say, you know, we think a watch with, you know, a titanium case and this kind of dial will work out really well. And then they could develop it and then we would ship it off to our members and get feedback based on that. So yeah, I love that business model in general. And with watches, you know, like I said, I was literally sitting in front of my computer on Namecheap. And I had this idea and I was like, well, let me just type in some names. And I think Watch Gang was like the second one I typed in and the .com was available. And I'm like, okay, bought it, threw it up on I think it was called Cratejoy. It was like this system that allowed you to do recurring business model. And made like an Instagram account. And the next day I had a sale and I didn't even have a watch to sell this person yet. And I didn't spend any money on advertising. And that is pretty rare. So I was like, this is kind of a cool idea. Let me expand on this. And yeah, just kind of grew it from there.
Yeah, a lot of people are hesitant to kind of make the perfect business, but they don't know if kind of a market will want that. And it's actually, like you said, it was smart because once that extra inventory, if you know, a watch brand sells it to, like you said, somebody like Walmart, it kind of devalues the brand if they want to be viewed a certain way. Yeah. You know what I mean? Just to kind of get that inventory out of there. And it kind of makes sense to also possibly expose that brand to an already established, a caring community that are into what they're, you know, selling. So it makes a lot of sense in terms of kind of a structure. So starting it at that point, what were kind of like the hurdles, you know, getting to 1 million, getting to 10 and then to 300 million, what are some of the things that you had to kind of overcome? Obviously you mentioned, a lot of companies suffered through the lockdowns and, you know, people being out of work, stuff like that during that time. But what are some of kind of the obstacles you overcome?
There were a lot in the beginning. For the first couple of months, it was just me doing everything. I was answering like customer service phone calls at 3 a.m. I was getting great emails, but also like crazy hateful emails. I sent a watch out to a guy, he hated it. And this was in like month 2. And I remember like opening my laptop in bed and looking at, and the email said, like, I'm glad your dad died. And I'm like, holy shit. All right. So, you know, it's just something that I went through enough times where I realized that people like that are probably just going through something else and they're just trolls and I can't take it personally. But eventually, you know, I started hiring some friends to handle things that I could take off my plate so I could work on the vision and the scaling. So some of the obstacles at first were just like, I mean, most of my friends were sort of out of work actors in LA and didn't know how to do the things that I was hiring them for, but they were smart and they had aptitude and we worked on it together and figured it out together. And so growing a company in that way, rather than hiring like, you know, a VP of a department has experience who then hires his team. I didn't do things in that way because we're bootstrapped anyway. So scaling was sort of an obstacle. You know, back then, Facebook ads were working so well that I could scale on advertising and get a ton of customers, but I had to keep turning it off because I didn't have enough inventory. And so it was constantly this sort of like battle to like grow advertising and then stop and then get enough watches. And then I had too many and then grow that. And so we just kind of kept stepping that up. And then, you know, then you hit this sort of plateau where once you scale enough in online marketing, the CAC, the acquisition costs, get so high that you're not sure if it's profitable anymore. Then you have to hire financial analyst or data analyst. And then, you know, it was just like I was figuring it all out for the first time. It was the first company that I had that had more than like 3 employees. And there were moments in the company's growth where, you know, I had to step back and just kind of slow down and appreciate what I had, which I'm not very good at doing. And I think when we hit like 10 million, that was a big moment for me. And I started like trying to fundraise. I was like, all right, well, maybe if I go through this VC route, if I do a Series A or something, that will make me happy and I can then grow without worrying about cash flow all the time. Because that's, since day one, has always been the main thing is cash flow. You're growing, sometimes unprofitably, just to kind of get the name out and grow, like sort of the Amazon model, knowing that you'll figure out profitability later with scale. I spent like a good 6 months to a year doing the fundraising route, getting bad term sheets. Now looking back, I'm like, maybe I should have taken one of them. But yeah, never did that. And then I think the biggest scare we ever had though was definitely COVID. You know, when the lockdowns happened, we were sort of riding high. Everything was great. And then I had to close the office down and figure out how do I run this business from home, especially because we had 3PLs that were shipping inventory for us and they were closing and not reliable. And so month 2 of the lockdown, we decided to bring everything in house, got a warehouse, had a few people that were able to come in and kind of, and still, you know, ship for us. And I guess we were classified as a vital business or something just because it was a warehouse. So you have to have a physical presence there. But I mean, our sales dropped like 40% overnight from that. And thankfully, we got a forgivable PPP loan that kept us open. Month 4 or something like that. And then, you know, a lot of e-commerce companies blew up after that because people are stuck at home and they're bored. And I was thinking this is the end because who wants to wear a watch when they're stuck in their house? But thankfully, I had a community and people kind of leaned on it. So they got their watch, then they log into their Facebook group and then they're like, hey, this is what I got. And they share and they talk. And then things were great for a year. And then the iOS update, the privacy update came in and like just wrecked our marketing again overnight. Like our marketing costs tripled. So 3x cost to get the same customer. And thankfully I had a subscription. So we at least had recurring revenue that helped us through that. But that crushed our sales for like a year. That was so hard. And then we finally start getting everything back together. And then this weird recession, Russian war, $7-$8 gas prices happen, and then, you know, going back again. So it's just this constant wave. And, you know, we're just sometimes we're surfing, sometimes we're drowning, and we're just kind of figuring it out still.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of adaptability when the challenge comes, and it's not, you know, giving up. A lot of companies, a lot of businesses, why they still are around are simply they outlast it. So because, you know, their competitors kind of, I don't necessarily say crumbled, but, you know, hit adversity and said, you know, this is not worth the battle. I'm just going to, you know, part ways with this. Or it's like, let's figure it out. I mean, there's always going to be something. Like you said, everything is a wave, you know, life is a wave. You're having, you know, good things happen, align business-wise, personal-wise, but in the back of your mind, that's not going to last. Bad times don't last. Good times don't last, and you have to kind of in the good times adapt and you know foresee some of the potential challenges. I mean, you can't necessarily foresee something like a potential war or potential, you know, a global pandemic, but some things you can kind of foresee. But kind of outlasting your competitors and moving and pivoting with whatever comes at you in life and in business, I think is, you know, key.
Yeah, we've seen several competitors pop up, maybe 4 or 5 over the years. And, you know, it's not an easy business to run, even when things are good. There are a lot of complexities and logistics that go into it. And we've seen those close. And I mean, even in like just my neighborhood, like 30% of small businesses closed down, unfortunately. And I've seen friends' e-com businesses close. And you're right, it's about being able to persist through that and last. And sometimes it's not possible, but if it is, and you can you know, we've had to do layoffs like throughout all of this. Like when sales are down 40%, like, you know, or we're staffed up for growth and then we're not growing. Like I had to make those hard decisions and it sucked. I hated that and I still hate it. It's like it's the worst part of actually running a company. Sometimes I wish I could just still be a software engineer and throw my headphones on and just code all day and let somebody else worry about, you know, the growth and profitability of a company and not take it home with me. But this is where I'm at.
Now, in terms of kind of like navigating the waters and not giving up in terms of when a challenge arises, do you think that's something that has benefited you in terms of your upbringing? So a certain amount of grit, knowing where you come from, what you've had to overcome. Do you feel like that's an aspect that helps you overcome that in business as well?
Absolutely. I definitely believe in my own sort of capabilities. I've had nothing. And so if I lost it all and I had nothing again, I know that I would figure it out. And it took me a while to kind of build that belief in myself. But when you sit around fearful all day that you're going to lose something, and then you really believe or you start to think, okay, well, I grew this, obviously with help of my friends and the people that I hired, but I've done this before with other things. Like, I'm the best person suited to make it out if this thing crumbles. So that helps me a bit. And it also kind of help. I kind of activate in chaos. And when things are scary, it kind of gives me extra drive. So I sort of welcome those challenges now.
Yeah, I feel some people are bad under pressure. And some people, when they put that pressure on themselves, they operate at a higher level. So like kind of working under pressure, I mean, in school and other areas of my life, I see myself kind of like, you know, maybe procrastinating, but procrastinating and then still in the last minute producing something because, you know, it's either you fail or, you know, you have the capability of doing this great thing. So, I mean, I don't necessarily know if that's the best example comparing procrastination with kind of like, you know, grit and overcoming challenges. But I feel like, you know, when you're pushed, put under pressure, you either make it or you don't. A lot of people, you know, me coming from Eastern Europe, I immigrated to the U.S. when I was 5. And, you know, we were on, you know, welfare and food stamps for a few months before my parents and grandparents got on their feet. And knowing where I came from, you know, as a former Soviet Union, knowing how life was there in terms of religious persecution and different things like that, I feel it adds a level of grit, regardless of, you know, people complain about the recession or the situation, knowing where you come from. It's like, I don't know, it's kind of like a bulletproof vest.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? When nobody's wearing one, you have this kind of like armor, knowing like, okay, like, you know, I've been through all of this in my life. I've come from this, you know, I can survive.
Yeah, you know, I like the contrast or the comparison to the procrastination, because essentially what you're doing is it's self-imposed chaos and pressure, you know, because it's on you to do it or not. Like, you can't blame anybody else for procrastinating. But I was the exact same way growing up. I remember having school projects that I would have like 6 weeks to prepare for, and I'm starting it the morning that it's due and finishing it in the bathroom before my class starts, you know, and I think that I still do some of those things in a way, because that's where I sort of thrive, and it's kind of self-inflicted, but if it works, it works. You know, I wonder, like, because of where you immigrated from and because of obviously the culture that you have with your family, it does give you an edge, right? And my edge, obviously I'm American. So my edge comes from growing up in poverty and having like, I mean, my dad was also similar to yours. That gives me some sort of grit and an edge. And I see people as like so soft when they don't have anything like that. You must feel the same way.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like I have a grin sometimes on my face. If I'm in like a store, or if I'm like a Dunkin' or a Starbucks, somebody throws a temper tantrum about not getting whipped cream in their coffee. I'm like, really? It's like a first world versus a third world problem. It's like, how significant is this when you know where you started and you know where it's just a level of a bubble and a comfort. And I feel like there's only a select amount of the population that if everything went wrong, every single possible variable, and we're in some kind of like, you know, Mad Max society, those are the people that step up because they've experienced a certain level of that in their lives. So what kind of currently motivates you to succeed, you know, in 2023, you know, potentially moving forward with the company, other exploits you have, other passions?
Because what else am I going to do? You know, like I get bored pretty easily when things aren't kind of crazy. So when it's a little too stable, I'm uncomfortable and I try to shake things up. And I always have my hands in other things as well. Just because I have a hard time sitting still. And when things are good, I think about, well, how do I change it or make it better or bigger? And so success to me looks maybe different than it does for most people. I don't think I'm ever going to retire. I don't see how that will ever make me happy. And sometimes I'm sort of, I don't know, not sad about it, but I wonder what it would be like if I could just enjoy stillness, but it's just not how I'm wired, I guess. So financial success is obviously a big thing, but I see it more as like a game now where, you know, I just want to keep making new things and selling them or earning more in that way, and then using that to do something else. The one consistent that I have is some level of philanthropy. I've been doing that in my company from the beginning, mostly always trying to benefit kids in some way, probably because of my background. And so I know that long term, what I want to do is work on something that influences and helps children in situations that I grew up in. So one day I'll work on that maybe full time. Right now I've got my toe in that water right now, and I'm slowly building it while I still work on my company.
Yeah, I think, I say a lot, and it's a reoccurring theme, complacency is the death of innovation, and basically comfort kills. So when you get to a plateau area, a certain level of success, you sell a company, some people just take their foot off the brake, and that's fine, you know, get a beach house or some kind of island situation and disappear. But it's like, if you're not constantly challenging yourself, I feel personally, you truly can't be great or like the maximum level of what you can become. And if you don't have a certain level of adversity, I don't think you can be great without adversity. Basically, like, nobody becomes a great sailor if they just hang out in the harbor, you know, their ship. Yeah. You have to be tested by storms and things of that nature.
My favorite saying is, calm seas make for shitty sailors.
Yep. And sometimes you have to kind of create. I know a lot of the times, like if you looked at, or, you know, Michael Jordan or other people successful in sport or their careers, he reached the top, like, pinnacle of, you know, being the best in the game at that time and arguably of all time. So at that time, he had to create villains in his own head. So there was a lack of competition, and it was constantly pushing himself to the next level. So oftentimes it's like, okay, this is great. For business, I have 80% market share. How do I get to 85? How do I get to 90? How can I reinvent the experience that I'm presenting? How can I reinvent, you know, satisfaction is high, but how can I get it better? So yeah, you can be good and then you can just stop, or you can continue to pursue greatness.
Yeah, I agree.
So what's kind of one thing you can leave with the audience in terms of advice, personal and professional, that can potentially, you know, benefit them, or something you've experienced that you feel like maybe fast track somebody to something, or a pitfall that they can avoid?
I think the biggest thing that people can really do is just find not their purpose, but maybe their motivation for something. Like, everybody wants something. And if they're listening to this podcast, or they're, you know, they're online watching the YouTube videos that sort of resonate with them around business, then they clearly have the desire. But what is the motivation behind it? And if you can hone in on why you want what you want, and really find a good reason and a purpose behind it, that can at least be the starting point to drive you in the right direction. Because a lot of people do just sit around and watch the videos, but they don't actually jump into action, and they're not sure how. And really, there's just infinite information now about that. So people just, what I've seen is they tend to start a million things and not really focus on one, or they keep watching the stuff and then they never start. Just start and fail a bunch of times, and then eventually you won't fail, and then you'll have something. And, you know, maybe people that don't have money to start something wonder, well, how can I even do that if I don't have money to invest? AI is free right now, and you can automate something enough to act to replace a low wage income right away, like almost immediately. And so I would say start looking at that. AI is sort of like a free virtual assistant at the moment, and it's anybody that's not looking at it is going to get left behind.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like the biggest thing is starting. So a lot of people watch, I don't know, Gary Vee or somebody get hyped up and say, hey, I'm going to do it. But actually starting something, or at least writing it down or getting it out of your mind and onto a piece of paper, or creating a business plan or some kind of roadmap, or at least one or two steps towards something, is the toughest part. And like you said, everybody will make excuses, but when you stop making excuses and actually do it, well, I don't have money. Well, I'm in this situation. Well, this, that, or the other. I mean, all you can do is be accountable. I feel like, you know, accountability is huge, and it's missing in a lot of businesses and careers where, you know, if something goes wrong, well, it's not my fault. You know, be accountable, learn from it, start something and move forward. I mean, you're the only person accountable right. for your own life. You can make as many as excuses for what happened to you or what's going on with you. But, you know, if you wake up tomorrow, you can change the trajectory of your life. So I really appreciate you stopping by today. Can you let the audience know how they can find you? Anything else you have going on?
Yeah, for sure. I'm on Instagram at MATTOMIC and at WatchGang. Is the watch company. And yeah, we're actually working on a new service that we're going to be launching in the next 3 months. I'm really excited about. So if you want to join like our newsletter, it's just watchgang.com and you'll be able to see there.
Awesome. Thanks again
of course,
for stopping
nice
by.
Nice to meet you, Roman. Thanks.
You as well.
This podcast has been brought to you by Nova Zora Digital. Find out how Nova Zora Digital can help your company grow online. Learn more at NovaZoraDigital.com. Until next time, all you digital savages.